Welcome to Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. This is episode 39, and I'm Martin, and this week I have been overclocking and underclocking GPUs with pretty tools.
And I'm Alan, and I've been eschewing Bash again for my new musical love, Python.
Hi, I'm Mark, and I've been trying out audiobook servers.
Following on from last episode, I have another pick of great tools for your GPU.
My GPU?
Everyone's GPU, hopefully. Well, I say everyone's GPU. No, I've got three picks here. I'm pretty sure everyone with a GPU can benefit from these three tools.
I'll get my Matrox Paralia three-headed card out then.
Oh, you're the customer. Could you remember those? Yes. My word.
Oh, God, I've set him off. I'm so sorry, listeners.
No, so you have set me off because I did read with interest recently that Matrox are going to be reintroducing proper GPUs. And they're going to be using Intel as their platform.
Golly.
So I think the Intel Battle Mage, which is going to be the next generation of Intel GPUs, Matrox are going to be a first-party OEM. So I'm actually quite looking forward to that, because back in the day, I remember my Matrox cards with, you know, fondness. They were brilliant. But I have to say, I'm pretty certain none of these tools are suitable for a Matrox anything.
I knew it.
The first tool I've got is called GPU Viewer. So this isn't about overclocking and underclocking, but this is another one of those great utilities. So GPU Viewer is a graphical application, and it's sort of the amalgamation of all of those command line tools that you use to dig out information from your GPU. So if you've ever run GLX info or Vulkan info or CL info or ES2 info or VA info, it's all the info tools, right? So it's an info like. I'm inventing another software category. Here we go.
Oh, God, somebody stop him.
So, GPU Viewer, it interrogates your GPU for all of its capabilities. So, everything it can do in terms of graphical capabilities and also compute. You know, what versions of the different APIs does it support? What capabilities within those versions of the APIs does it support? It's a tool that you'll reference infrequently. But when you need to find out something about your GPU, this is the way to do it. I recently used it. I've been poking around in game engines, and I was trying to work out what version of the rendering backend to use. And in order to understand that, there's all sorts of like different compatibility matrices of, you know, this version of OpenGL and this version of Vulkan. And I used this to like figure out what the most compatible path was to be. Something that could target the most number of users possible. So it's a great little utility.
Can it produce a text-based report as well as everything graphical on the screen?
I actually don't know. I've only used it in the graphical version because I was just interrogating my systems and just having a look at the basic capabilities for it's Vulkan that I was mostly interested in because I'm kind of new to that and I didn't understand some of the feature set.
Yeah, I realize it's a GUI tool, but you know, a lot of these things have a system that enables them to export out all the data. So, you know, if you're using it to gather data for technical support or something.
Yeah, I mean, if it doesn't do that, that would be a good feature. There's I've got a bonus for you that isn't in my notes. There's a tool I've played with recently called WayCheck, which actually interrogates your current Wayland compositor for the capabilities that it supports, the Wayland protocols that are supported. And that's a graphical only tool, but that's definitely something that would benefit from precisely what you've described, being able to dump, you know, a whole load of text-based information to be able to mine that a bit more effectively.
Nice.
So let's get into the meat and potatoes here, the overclocking and underclocking part. I think the first tool I've got here, most people, or at least most people that have got an NVIDIA GPU and have used Linux, will be familiar with. It's called Green with Envy.
I see what they did there.
Yeah.
I didn't see what they did there.
Green is NVIDIA's logo and NV is NVIDIA.
Okay, I get it now.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a fantastic tool. So I've used this in the past, mostly to overclock NVIDIA GPUs. And I'll get to why you want to overclock and underclock stuff a bit later. But I think one of the issues that we've had in recent times with Linux is we see what people do on Windows, particularly tech reviewers talk about new GPUs and what their overclocking capabilities might be and what their game performance might be and how to improve the fan speed curve, for example, or apply a bit more power to the GPU to eke a bit more out of it. And desktop Linux really hasn't been great for that. So mostly these tools are to give sort of computing parity to Linux users. If you've got an NVIDIA or AMD GPU, then, you know, these are the tools to use. So Green with Envy is a terrific tool. It can access the fan control and the power profile and something else. I forget what this something else is.
Voltages?
It's not voltages these days. It's because it's all power and cooling based. All of the modern platforms work out what they can do based on how much thermal headroom and power headroom they have. So I think it's those two. Mostly you can toggle. Anyway, the advantage is you can choose to supply more power or less. And the reason I've been using this recently is that I actually have a second NVIDIA GPU in one of my laptops and both my workstations. And the only thing I use it for is video encoding. So what I've been using it for is to actually draw back the power to the NVIDIA GPU to basically nothing, because I'm not using the GPU at all. I'm basically using the NVENC ASIC, which sips power. So I can dial back the power that's going to the NVIDIA GPU and drive it way, way down to just a couple of watts.
I did not know that that's what it did. I thought that it just used the GPU because it was better at encoding than your CPU would be. I didn't realize it actually had a separate chip which didn't need very much power.
Yes. So in the case of NVIDIA, NVENC is basically an ASIC, which is one of the features of the SoC.
Huh.
Now, there are some additional capabilities that you can turn on in the NVENC encoder. I think some of the psycho-visual profiles do borrow a bit of GPU compute, but they're optional things that you can enable when you do the encode. So you can do everything with NVENC, but also borrow a bit of compute from the GPU if you want to. Now, the only drawback with Green with Envy and with the similar AMD tool that I'm going to talk about is you have to enable this thing called Cool Bits. And this is a feature in the NVIDIA driver, which is basically a binary bit mask to define what capabilities you want access to. And nothing screams, I care about my user experience more than do some binary arithmetic now, please, customer. So I'll save you all some time. There is only one number you need to supply to Cool Bits. And
is it 42?
No, it's 28.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
Yes. I'll have links to Green with Envy and the Cool Bits documentation in the NVIDIA manual. But with Cool Bits enabled, that basically unlocks the NVIDIA driver to control the power target and the cooling. And you can move the power target in both directions, therefore overclocking or undervolting, underclocking. And for AMD, this is a tool that's quite new to me. It's called the Linux AMD GPU Configuration Tool, or LACT, L-A-C-T. And I didn't know this existed until quite recently. When I've gone hunting for how to control AMD GPUs in terms of like power and overclocking in the past, the standard answer seems to have been core control, which I've bounced off it quite a lot. It feels a bit limited and the UI's weird and it didn't seem to expose much capability of what you could do with the GPU. But LACT is amazing. It exposes absolutely everything, and a bit like Green with Envy, you can nice sliders in a graphical environment to control power target, fan curves, fan profiles, the whole kit and caboodle. So again, just like everything you'd expect to find in the equivalent tools on Windows to control your GPU overclocking, I absolutely love this. And also, not to be outdone, similar to Green with Envy, it requires a kernel parameter, which is also a bitmask to turn on the features to basically unlock the capability to do that. Now, if you're listening carefully, what you want here is hexadecimal. It's FFFD7FFF. That's what you need in your kernel arguments. I'll put that in the show notes for you. But with that in the kernel parameters, again, you can control a whole bunch of stuff with your GPU. And the reason I've been doing this is that I have AMD GPUs as my primary GPU in my workstations and my laptops. And these laptop GPUs these days are more than capable of driving a desktop, like the GNOME desktop or one of the Wayland compositors or one of the traditional desktops. They can eat that up for lunch all day long.
Even NVIDIA?
Yeah, the NVIDIA GPUs can as well, no problem. And similar to what I was saying about that second NVIDIA GPU, I've been able to dial back the power consumption of my AMD GPUs, particularly those that are on SoCs in my laptops, to sip power and extend the battery endurance. So whilst these tools are generally used to squeeze out a bit more gaming performance when you're playing games, particularly on platforms like the handheld, you know, gaming devices that are popular these days, I find them very useful to do the very opposite of that, which is to dial everything back to low power mode in order to make your battery run for like an hour or more, you know, when you're just doing casual development stuff on the desktop. The other way I've used LACT recently is I got to borrow one of these AMD Radeon RX 7900 GRE GPUs. Now, if you're not familiar with this, this was a special edition that was actually released in China exclusively for the China market last year. And then AMD were kind of forced to respond to some NVIDIA GPUs. So they released this GPU in the Western market as well. And it was sort of a cut down 7900. And its drawback was, is that they basically sort of bottlenecked the memory performance. But using LACT, you can overclock the memory and bring it back up to a performance similar to the full fat version of the 7900. So I was able to unlock free performance on that GPU.
I always worry that you're going to break something with these. Like, you're going to overclock it and, you know, oh, if I touch it, I might break it. Not like that, but, you know, like, you'd make something overheat or you'd like blow out the thermal paste because it'd be too hot.
So those aren't really concerns for today. The CPUs and GPUs that are made these days have thermal shutdown. So the worst that can happen is you crash your machine. And when you're overclocking, that's the most likely outcome. And none of these sliders that move the power targets are changing like the firmware behavior. It's temporary. So when it reboots with the default configuration. So you're not going back into an unstable place.
Got it.
So I have absolutely crashed my desktop on many occasions because you can go too low, you can try and scoop out too much power, or you can try and supply too much. Either will end in disaster, but it's temporary. And I've also used these tools in the past. I still have a system from 2018 that is number 3 in the Gaming on Linux Superposition Benchmarks. and I managed to get to that lofty position with my 3090 by using Green with Envy and some other overclocking capabilities of my own in order to make that thing sing. So you can have some fun with this as well if you want to go and do some competitive overclocking and benchmarking with other Linux nerds.
I have been reaching for Python instead of Bash, which is my usual hammer to hit everything.
And what have you been reaching with your Python this time?
I've been reaching parts I previously had not been able to reach with my Python. And the thing that tickled me with my Python this week was music, specifically the Spotify API. And I'm a paying subscriber to Spotify. Emails about that to DevNull, I don't care. And the thing I wanted to do was programmatically search using their API for songs that met certain criteria that I could then put into a playlist and then process them. And by process them, I mean listen to them and then decide whether I want to keep them or not. And the reason I would not want to keep them is if I don't like them, or they don't grow on me, and I might keep them if I like them. And the reason why this is a bit weird is because I'm really used to listening to the same set of songs all the time. Like for the last like 20 years, I've got some playlists of songs I really like, and I've decided that I'm bored of those. And this happened because during August, I was doing No Cast or Gast, which was like I wasn't listening to any podcasts for the whole of the month, which meant I was listening to a lot of music, which was great. Mm-hmm. But every morning and every evening to and from work, I was listening to some of the same songs. I'm getting a bit bored of it. So I thought, well, what's the solution to this that's more interesting than just subscribe to the daily, weekly, what's up, what's down, Spotify, auto-generated AI playlist or whatever it is. I thought I could do something with this. So I wrote a bit of Python, and the goal was to find only new music because I wanted to counteract all the old music that I had. And so I would search the API only for songs that were released within the last 11 days. And those songs that were released within the last 11 days would be rolling because I would run this script every day. And so things that were older than 11 days would roll off the playlist, and new songs that had just been released would roll in. And so I would have this constant supply of new songs every day, so long as I keep running this script to fill my playlist up.
Is this a playlist in Spotify?
Yes.
Right.
So I created a playlist, and then there's an API call you can make to add songs to the playlist. Simple as that, right? You do a search and you filter the results, then you put them in your playlist, and that works perfectly fine. You can remove them as well. And what I then did was add an extra step that would look for any songs that I liked in Spotify. So if I actually liked them by clicking the I like this song button, then when it came to remove them from that playlist, it put them to one side in another good songs playlist that I can come back to and listen to those again. So that the main playlist was just this rolling window of 11 days of songs I like, or I might like, that are new to me. And any that I didn't like, and by didn't like, I mean either I didn't listen to them or I didn't click the little like button, it just went into the Room 101 playlist where I'm probably never going to listen to it, but I wanted to keep a record of the ones that I didn't like so I can see how many I did like and how many I didn't like at the end of this experiment.
When it's searching for songs, is the only criterion it was released in the last 11 days, or do you have some other parameters for what you think you might be interested in and you only let it present you with that?
Yes, there are other criteria. So you can choose genre, for example. Or you can search for, there are a couple of tags. Most of the time it's going to show you fairly new, fairly popular music. But if you hit the API enough times, you can go down the list and down the list and down the list and get quite a lot of songs. So it won't just be the three songs that everyone's listening to this week. It will be, others. And you can filter them. And if there's genres that you know you don't like, death metal or whatever, then I can just filter those out. And so I started this and I ended up with some songs in the list, and I was like, this is great. I like these. These are good songs. I quite like these. But I exhausted the list pretty quickly because there aren't actually that many new songs released in 11-day period. So I had to expand it. And the way I expanded it was, if you search by genre, then it shows up songs that don't show up in just a general search, because Spotify is trying to show you the popular stuff by default. And if you search by genre, then you find other stuff. And so I was finding even more stuff that I had not seen before. And initially I thought, if I do this over an 11-day window and I keep the playlist only 60 songs, that sounds about right. So I called my playlist Popey's Dynamic Playlist 11/60, or PDP 11/60, which I thought was tremendously nerdy, naming it after an old deck computer from the past. And then I realized that this playlist would be public and that everyone would see it, and I'm probably going to blog about it and talk about it here. And so Martin suggested calling it something a little bit more sensible. And so Martin came up with the name Virtual Zane Lowe, who is apparently a DJ. And so my playlist is called Virtual Zane Lowe, and it's exactly that. It's a moving window of 11 days. However, I have since broken the script and it's not working quite as I was hoping. So I need to debug it. But that's the joy of working with Python. It's a new thing to me. It's a new API that I haven't used before. And I'm actually enjoying writing the code as much as I am listening to the music, which is good. So it's a double whammy of success. I'm really enjoying it.
Following my previous discussion about audiobook apps and how I listen to audiobooks on my phone, I got some recommendations from our listeners about some audiobook servers. So what I described before is how I use Nextcloud to sort of progressively download chapters of the audiobook I'm listening to and then delete old ones so I don't have to download, you know, hundreds and hundreds of megabytes at the beginning of each book. But another way of doing this is you have your audiobook on a server and it streams to your phone or other device as you're listening. And there were a couple that I was recommended, so I'm going to discuss them and let you know which one I settled with. The first one is called BookSonic. And as you might be able to guess from a previous segment, it's based on Subsonic. It's actually a fork of the AirSonic server, which is used for streaming music. But it's been rejigged for audiobook management because, as I discussed before, the features that you want when you're listening to audiobooks aren't the same as you want when you're listening to music. You don't necessarily want things like shuffle or, you know, playlists of, you know, chapters from different books together. But you do want things like remembering your position in various different books at the same time and sleep timers and things like that. So that's the reason that this exists when there are already plenty of Subsonic servers out there, which could stream audiobooks. As well as the server, there's a companion app for Android based on an app called DSub. There's a Docker image available, which I got running, but I had a bit of trouble from there on. I couldn't get it to show me my books. It said it was indexing them and told me how many it had indexed, but it didn't show me any. There wasn't a whole lot of documentation. It's kind of a one-man show. The developer has some blog posts about it, but that seemed to be about the extent of the documentation, so I couldn't get much further than that.
When it was inside your Docker container, was it exposed so you could control it via a web UI in some way?
Exactly. Right, okay. Yes, so it was exposed via the web, so I could theoretically connect an app to it, and I could get to it via the web UI, yes, and it could see my audiobooks, but that was... I couldn't see my audiobooks through it. The app is in the Play Store and is £3. So I thought, well, if I install the app, I'd be able to see my books. But I couldn't pay for it. Payment kept failing. So because it's an open source app, I thought, that's fine, I'll build it myself. Which it says, you know, if you want it free, go ahead and build it. But I couldn't get it to work and I couldn't find any documentation for that either. So at this point, I moved on to the next recommendation from our listeners, which is Audio Bookshelf.
I've heard of this.
Yes. So Audio Bookshelf is a standalone project, not forked off of existing stuff. It's also completely open source. It has a server and a client, both called Audio Bookshelf for audiobook management and streaming. It also supports podcasts, although I haven't looked at that because I don't feel the need to have my podcasts on a server of my own. I just download them, listen to them, and get rid of them. I don't keep an archive of podcasts. And it supports companion ebooks. So if you have an ebook of an audiobook, it can also index those, although it can't index ebooks by themselves. Similarly to BookSonic, it had a Docker image. It also had documentation for setting up an Nginx reverse proxy, which is what I do. And that all worked quite well. When you index your books, you can search various sources for metadata, including Google Books, Audible, and Open Library. So if you have stuff that's not in Audible, you can also source cover art and things like that. And the client is also in the App Store, and it's free, and it works.
Nice. Actually, it's also worth noting, you said stuff that's not in Audible. If you have stuff that is in Audible, I'll remind everyone that there is an app called Libation, which can yoink all of your audio out of Audible and store it as playable audio files that will play on pretty much anything.
And you can stick those in your audio bookshelf server and stream them wherever you like.
Nice.
The key things that it can do for me is you can either download the whole book or you can stream it on the go. And I have done that where I've left the house and streamed it over 4G. And most of the time I'm in the house streaming it over Wi-Fi, all good. It shows the overall progress of the book as a whole, but also shows the progress within a chapter. And you can then seek within that chapter and skip forward and back chapters. It remembers the playback position for multiple books, because I have a book that I'm listening to at bedtime, but I also have other stuff that I might be listening to during the day or when I'm gaming and stuff like that. So I need it to be able to jump back into different points in different books without forgetting it. And it has a sleep timer for that nighttime reading where I can, say half an hour and then it'll turn itself off and not play the entire book to me subliminally.
Oh, that's nifty.
Yes. I have had a little bit of trouble with one of the books, which I think is down to it being variable bitrate encoded. And I found there's a setting in, I can't remember if it's in the app or the server. I think it's in the app where it will change how it does seeking for it. Basically, it means it takes a bit longer to find its position towards the end of a longer book, but it works with variable bitrate. So I've just turned that on and I'm going to see if it solves the problem. But other than that, I could not be happier with this. It's an absolutely brilliant piece of software.
Nice.